Let's see. I would like to introduce to you tonight speaker Cheryl Kay from Wildomar.
Thank you.
I'm a hugger.
Oh, I'm a hugger.
Can I get this?
Yep, you want this?
Oh, yeah. Vertically challenged.
There you go.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello.
I rose to the occasion. Oh, my God. I am definitely an alcoholic. My name is Cheryl.
Hi, Cheryl.
My sobriety date is December 3rd, 1974. So last December, I got my 51-year chip, and my best buddy comes up, John. He says, Cheryl, how many cards are in a deck of cards? And I go, 52. He says, honey, you're still not dealing with a full deck. I tell you, oh, it's always somebody putting you in your place. Well, I want to thank you for inviting me down, John and Michelle. You guys really, this has been something I've been looking forward to, because south of the border here in 1972, I was at the Rosarita Hotel slamming down shots of tequila and the such. And we walk out of the hotel, and I've got on these cute little linen pantaloons in this cute little top, and I just walk right into a palm tree. It looked like it was a sexual event because I couldn't get off the darn thing. I'm struggling. He's laughing his ass, and I'm so mad by this time. Well, I shredded those pants, but I did get off that palm tree. And then to go there, you know, 10 years later, sober, what an event. It was quite something. I was actually born in Alameda, California, 9 months after World War II. You remember that event? Yeah. My dad was a railroad man. And he tried to get into the military, but they wouldn't take him because he was important to the national defense. So there was an oddity about that. People who saw healthy-looking men running around weren't too cool about them. They thought they should be in the military. And I'm an only child, and I remained an only child all my life. But the thing that was really funny about that is that we moved a lot because of the railroad. It's very much like the military. And what we were doing is we would go from town to town, and I was born in Alameda but lived in Oakland at least two or three times, Salinas, Watsonville, Gilroy, Santa Cruz, et cetera, just the whole Bay Area, one way or another. And then we got booted out of California and moved to a little town in Carlin, Nevada, but that's another story. I really want to tell you more about what it was like. I'm 2 years old. There's a picture of me coming out of a doghouse with a 32-ounce bottle of beer under my arm, just grinning. You know, just grinning. And they thought it was cute back then. You know, oh, let her have a little sip. Just have a little sip. Well, a guy sipped myself silly. And a two-year-old toddler being alcoholically drunk is not cute to cute after a while. But what that was is it was the beginning of my journey into alcoholism. And by the time I'm 12 years old, we're living in Carlin, Nevada. I believe it's the armpit of America, if there is an armpit. And my dad works for the Southern Pacific, and Bertie Jensen's dad worked for the Union Pacific. And she was a family of 12 kids, and I'm an only child. And we were both outcasts, because my dad is basically the boss of this town. Everybody works for my dad. Well, if something went wrong at work that day, they'd go home, tell their wives, the kids would come to school and just kick the heck out of me. So I had issues, to say the least. And I was always on the outside. And not only that, I was about 12 years old, and back in 1949 and 50, braces were unheard of. They looked like railroad tracks. You know, they could bring in radio signals. And you wore this bridle, and you talked like this. And, of course, kids are just mean as all get out, you know. And when Dad would, like I said, do something that upset the fathers tell the mother, the kids come home to school and just give it to me. And the only reason I didn't commit suicide is that he bought me a horse. And I was able to go out into the country and ride that horse and stay away from those kids. But it was also the beginning of my first impulse drinking. They talk about in step one. Bertie comes to me and she says, my grandmother's just made a bottle of Logan Wary wine. And it tasted just like pancake syrup. It was so bad. Anyway, we also took a bottle of aspirins into the root cellar, which was on my property, and we were going to get it on. Yeah. Well, I want to tell you, 20 minutes later, I now knew as an alcoholic how I was going to drink. I became a projectile vomitist. Every time I drank, I threw up. And I was very popular in high school. I always had one boyfriend, always one date, because I'd throw up in their car. And they didn't, you know, they weren't too fond of that sort of stuff. But, you know, back then with covered wagons and wood-burning refrigerators, that's what we did. And we'd go out into the boondocks in Scottsdale, Arizona. That's where we wound up there. And they still had horses going down the main street back then. And we're out there in the boondocks. It, you know, 2 miles out of town was the boondocks. We'd circle our cars into a big circle. There was no such thing as stereos then. But we all were smart. We all turned to the same radio station and turned it up in volume. And we put the beer keg in the middle in the bonfire. And half an hour later, the cops come out and we go scattering into the desert. But boy, that was fun. And we did, like my typical time, drinking one more time. I wound up throwing up. Like I said, one date Cheryl. So by this time, I have now experienced my impulse drinking, but I liked it. And this set me up for that compulsive drinking. Now, I didn't have to drink every day, but I made sure that if there was going to be a party, I was going to make sure there was alcohol there. And we'd go over to our girlfriend's house, you know, we'd skip school, and we'd sit there, and somebody'd bring rum, and somebody'd bring scotch, and somebody'd bring gin, and we'd put it all together, get sick as all get out, but God, we was having so much fun, so much fun. By this time, I have learned all about getting through school just to survive. And my mom's drinking at this time had just started rearing its head. So I spent a lot of time alone. My dad was working. He would always be leaving town. Mom was there by herself, or she would take off. And I'm 12 years old, and she'd be gone for 2 or 3 days, and Dad isn't there. So I'm basically raised like a feral cat, whoever would take me in. And that was a funny thing is there was people around the corner from our home that had the same last name as we did, and our mail was constantly getting confused. And I met these people. And for some reason, they were my savior. They basically kept me safe because I didn't have much in the way of parental guidance at that point. It's not that my dad didn't want to. His job just took him away from the house. By this time, I'm probably doing okay in school. In fact, I graduated 19th from my school. And I'm sitting there looking at this thing, and Arizona State gave me an opportunity to join them. Well, when I got to Arizona State, I majored in boys, booze, and buffoonery, and I flunked all three, and I got a 1.9 grade average, and the dean of the college says, Cheryl, why don't you just move over and give the room to somebody who really wants this education? So I did the right thing. I moved to California, got pregnant, and got married. That's what you do. So there wasn't much in the way of alcohol at the time, except when opportunities came up, and I'm still in that compulsive stage. By the time I'm 24, I've had my second child. I'm in there with a newborn that was so sick, we didn't think she would make it. In fact, she was there for 10 days and several transfusions. It was something about the Rh factor. They've since solved that problem, but back then it was still new. And I'm sitting there, and I get a phone call, and it's from the coroner, and they said, your mother has passed away. And I'm living in Orange County, and she's in North Hollywood. That, for some reason, triggered me, because I had told my mother, don't you come down and see this child drunk. Well, she never could draw that sober breath to come see that child. And then I felt so guilty about her not being there. And I was always the outside kid. As I said, coming into new towns, I was always the new kid. And you know, kids are mean. They're they'll do anything just to rattle your cage. So I realized, being an only child, we were in a community in a time when it was multiple children. You know, if you had 5 or 6 kids in the family, you were normal. And then here's this, seeing this only child coming into town. Why don't you have brothers or sisters? What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? So I did the right thing. I invented brothers and sisters. Okay, cool. Where are they? Oh, they died. How? Plague. You know, but what it did, it created empathy. I had, oh, you poor thing. Finally had a connection. And all that, I carried that through all the way into adulthood. All the way, whatever I was taught those first 7 years is where the tree grew. And I learned to lie, and I did it so well, I believed it. And when I told it to my sponsor, she said, you did what? My sponsor was from Texas, and I fall into her voice every time I talk about her, so wait until I get there. It was a matter of just knowing that I was an outsider, always living on, trying to be funny, trying to be, you know, you can't not have issues going on. Because I was even raised, like I said, during the war, and I'm 2 years old, and all my play buddies are black. And I think I'm black, and the little girl comes to me, she said, you ain't black, you white. I knew I was different from that point on. What's wrong with me? I don't fit with anything or with anybody. So by the time I hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of happened Thanksgiving of 1974. I was married. I had two kids. I had 32 family outlaws, in-laws, cousins, nephews, sisters, and brothers-in-laws. And they were all going to come to my home for Thanksgiving. Well, that's all fine and good. But the thing of it is, I don't have the help. Now, my sister, Virginia, she has a housemaid, and she's got the help, and she lives in Palm Springs, and she. And I'm having a real hard time with that. So I was absolutely grumbling about it, but I did start the turkey that night. In fact, I cooked it all night. We were going to be ready for the turkey, so I bring it out of the oven. It's about a 28-pound bird. It's a heavy bird. And I drop the darn thing on the floor. Well, it looks like turkey succotash at this point. But I scooped it up, dog hair and all, and that's the way I served it. No. Now, for some reason, my husband the next day, and he never mentioned my drinking, he said, Cheryl, do you think you drink too much? And I thought, you got to be kidding. No, why would you say that? Well, I must have been doing this whole thing in a blackout. Well, I didn't get sober that day, but the 2nd of December was our first Christmas party at the golf club I belonged to. And I got there, and back in 1974, $273 could buy a lot of booze. And I only took $12 with me. And I had fortified myself before the party, had $12, and I figured, well, once I've done that, you know, I'll cut myself. I was controlling it so well. And if you've ever taken Ex-Lax, that's how you can control your alcohol. You can't. And I'm sitting there wondering how I can control myself into this situation. It turned out that I got there, and I drank mine, then I drank yours, and they had free wine on the table, so I drank that too. But like I said, my favorite project, and so I had to go into the bathroom and take care of that. Well, I wandered into the wrong bathroom, and it's men's bathroom, and I'm looking at the floor, and I'm seeing these shoes walking around. They're not women's shoes. So I just kind of pulled my feet up on the toilet and sat there and waited. Now, this may not be a social drinking, but that's the way it was for me. That night, I drove home, and my higher power with a zipper, oh, by the way, that his name was Warren. That's who I was married to. I had left me a snarky note. Well, I showed him. I drank our liquor, I threw that up. I drank his liquor, I threw that up. I drank my liquor, I threw that up. But somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm not sure if it was two, I experienced what they call alcohol poisoning. I could not move off that body. I could not pass out. My mind was going a million miles an hour. And I looked around and I could tell by looking out over the city that the lights were starting to become lighter and that it was starting to become morning, and I can't get off that couch. I'm afraid because my kids are going to be waking up, my husband's going to be waking up, and here I am stuck on this couch. And by this time, I not only had vomited on myself, I had also had to go to the bathroom. So I'm a hot mess, to say the least. So I went around, finally, willed myself off that couch, willed myself just to go just around the corner, which is about the other side of this tree behind me. That's how far I had to crawl. Pulled myself up to the counter, looked into the mirror. I saw the devastation of the alcohol. I saw my nose look like Rudolph. My cheeks had Arizona road maps on them, the crusted vomit. What a beautiful sight. And all I could think of is, God, I don't want to die like her. You see, my mother died of this disease at the age of 43. She was a beautiful woman, was a Coca-Cola model in 1938, certainly had the looks, certainly had the brains, but she died of this disease. And I swear today, my mother is the one that got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had to go visit a friend the next day, and I said, Em, I think I have a problem. And she says, what's that? And I said, I think I have a drinking problem. She says, well, why don't you go to your doctor? And I said, oh, I can't. He's Mormon. They don't drink. And she says, well, why don't you go to your minister? Oh, no, he's too godly. She says, well, why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, it doesn't work. My mom tried it, and she died. Now, you got to look at this little gal. She's 4'10", and she looked at me. She says, Cheryl, you're looking for sympathy, and that's in the dictionary between shit and syphilis. That hurt my feeling. So what do you do? I picked up the phone. I went to a meeting in a little town called Garden Grove, and there was a meeting there. A woman picked me up. Her name was Flo, and you know, she had blue hair. Not the kind of blue hair the kids have today, but the Mrs. Stewart bluing blue. And you go into this meeting, and there's 32 women sitting in there, and they're smoking cigarettes, they're drinking coffee, they're knitting, and they're nodding. Knitting and nodding, smoking cigarettes. And that was my introduction into Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, needless to say this is a program of attraction, right? I'm looking at these blue-haired ladies. I'm 32 years old. Everything on me is tight, taut, and perky. And I look at them, and I look at myself today. Everything that was tight, taut, and perky now flaps, flops, flies. It's been surgically removed, and now there's body parts that they're replacing. So all you newcomers, keep coming back if you want what I have. That's what happened. That's what happened. But I'm sitting in that meeting, and I'm looking around, and I'm shaking like a leaf. I can't hold that coffee cup. In fact, I invented Frappuccino before Frappuccino was even invented. And I'm sitting there like trying to hold this coffee. But the first act of kindness in Alcoholics Anonymous is a friend reached over and she steadied that cup so I could have that drink. That was my first introduction into AA. And then after the meeting was over, they grabbed your hand and we said the Lord's Prayer, and I thought I joined a cult. And then Big Dorothy comes over, who weighs 350 pounds and 6'2", says, I just love you. I'm sure she's hot for my body. I know it. But as it turned out, she was the one that also said, we're going to love you until you can love yourself, sweetheart. Just hang on. Things will change. One of the first admonitions, they said, hey, Cheryl, get yourself a sponsor. Well, what's that? Well, she explained she's the one that takes you through the book, the steps, and teaches the ropes and all that and the other. And the first sponsor I had was from the country club. I lucked what she had. She had a beautiful backswing, so I asked her to be my sponsor. And she fired my fanny about 7 days later because I had the wrong attitude for some reason. I can't imagine what it was. You know, she would make suggestions, but I heard when a sponsor makes a suggestion, it's really a silent demand. And I just wasn't willing to do it. And so she says, why don't you find somebody that's more to your liking? Well, that hurt my feelings, so I had to go out and shop around for another sponsor. Well, this one had 2 years of sobriety, and she was on fire, and we'd go out, and we'd talk, and we'd clean toilets and coffee pots and cigarette butts, and we were doing everything of service. But funny thing, she sought through prayer and medication to improve her conscious contact with God, and she had a mental breakdown. So I'm out looking again. And so on July 4th of 1975, I had, of course, it's a holiday, and the kids had apparently got into the watermelon the night before and spilled it on the floor. And I'm patty-footing around on watermelon slime from the floor, and I'm grumbling and griping about that. And my kids at this point aren't real thrilled that I'm in AA because all of a sudden I started becoming a mom. And they didn't like that. What do you mean I have to do my homework? What do you mean I have to go to bed? What do you mean I have to bed? You know, I mean, they were just not happy. I wish you were drunk. You know, well, thank goodness their wishes didn't come true. But I went to that meeting in Garden Grove, and there she was, my sponsor. And my sponsor was from Texas. And when she would say things, I was like taking a tranquilizer because I could slow down and I could listen. And she was trying to put me through the big book, through pages 1 through 164, especially we focused on the steps, 63 pages, 65. But it was like Chinese to me. Now, when I was a kid, I had a reading disability. Not because I couldn't read, it's just that California changed the way they taught. First it was sight reading, then they changed it to phonics. And by fourth grade, I still can't read. And a teacher caught me. And then she caught me after school, and she says, Cheryl, are you having difficulty reading? Well, I burst into tears. And that back then, you could actually keep the kids after school, teach them, and then drive them home. But that's way back when covered wagons and wood-burning refrigerators were around. But that's what she did. But before the end of that semester, that same teacher had me sit up on the table at the front of the class and read Black Beauty to the rest of the class. That's when things started changing. Even though I still had those braces, still had that speech impediment, still had that, you know, my grandmother would fat me up when I'd go back to Oklahoma and my mom would thin me down. So I was constantly in a state of flux as to who Cheryl was. But the bottom line is all that garbage is what Cheryl brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. And we heard a friend say it the other night, there's one thing about your childhood, it's over. Don't live in it. But here I brought all that baggage. And so by the time Pat got me into the steps, she says, honey, I want you to suckle at the nurturing breast of sobriety. That did not set well with me. But you got to understand, that accent meant a lot to me. Because I'd call her up in my higher power with a zipper. You know what he did today? Do you know what he did this and he did that? And she'd say, honey, that's BS and I can smell it. And that hurt my feeling. I mean, come on. Well, about 9 months of sobriety, the same man who I had used to drink with, I was fixing dinner, and he's standing there with a martini, which is one of my favorite flavors. And he goes, Cheryl, why don't you just try some controlled drinking? He says, I miss you. Well, I went to Fountain Valley, as far away from Tustin as I could, to tell on him. Do you know what he did? You know what he said? He wants me to try some controlled drinking. So John comes up after meeting. He's 6'7". I'm looking right into that man's belt buckle. And he looks down and goes, Cheryl, I want you to go home and give that man 3 tablespoons of X-Lax and show you control. I almost did it. But that taught me something about step one. I am powerless over alcohol. About the only thing Cheryl can control today with great stress is my bladder and my bowels. Everything else is out of my control, including my alcoholism, including my desire to drink. The desire to drink wasn't something that I held on to for very long because for some reason I was so ready when I came to that first meeting that I've been able to stay. But there was all these friends of mine that were going out and they were testing the water, so to speak. And it was one of those times that I really felt different, even in Alcoholics Anonymous. Coming up on my first birthday, I wound up saying, do I have to go out and drink again before my first birthday? I see so many of my people, my friends doing that. What they did is 7 or 8 women called me that afternoon and said, Cheryl, it's not necessary. I got here 15 years ago, didn't have to take a drink. I got here 12 years ago, didn't have to take a drink. You don't have to, honey. It's not a requirement for AA. It was that kind of love that made it easy. It was that kind of love that just made my heart just go, okay, maybe there's a chance. So by getting through that step one, that powerlessness, and a God was not in my vocabulary. In fact, when I prayed, it was to whom it may concern, because it was there was so much confusion. Like I said, I moved a lot as a kid, 17 times before I graduated high school. Every town had a different church, having a different way of doing it. And I didn't know whether you're supposed to stand, sit, kneel, whatever. I didn't know how. I didn't know if I was doing it right. So I would just go, to whom it may concern. And so the sponsor said, Cheryl, borrow mine, he's safe. Well, I found out he was a Southern Baptist God, but it worked. And you know what? I say that for a real good reason. 15 years I borrowed my higher power from my sponsor because I didn't know what mine was. And it told me in step two that I was going to be restored to sanity. Well, it also says that you have to believe in something other than yourself. Well, she said, if you can't believe of a God, try the group. Good early direction. Group of drunks. Dog, spelled backwards. God. Just believe it's not you, that there is something. Listen to the group. So I borrowed that. That kept me going. Even though I acted as if, I still got the results. And when they tell you about turning your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him, I had no understanding. But I did find one day a Native American woman by the name of Beverly Beaver, and she looked at me and she says, Cheryl, did you ever see that National Geographic picture of the Earth from space, the big blue marble? And I go, yeah. She says, do you think a committee invented that world? And I said, oh, good Lord, no. I said, we can't even agree on a coffee pot in an AA meeting. She says, what if, just maybe, this entity invented the air, the land, and the sea, and the water? And I said, okay, maybe we call this entity by different names, maybe we worship in different ways, but I think we're all talking maybe to the same entity. Just doesn't matter, does it? And I said, no. But I'll tell you what she did do. She gave me something called the Creator's Prayer. Creator, thank you for all the gifts you have given me, for there are many. Creator, thank you for removing all those things that have been harmful to me. But above all, Creator, thank you for what you've left me, for these are the things I learned from, and therefore I'm grateful. When I'm talking about the gifts given was my sobriety, the health of my family, my kids, getting an education in sobriety, actually going back to school instead of a 1.9, graduating with a 3.95. That's a gift. Being able to stay sober under incredible conditions, that's a gift. Things that were removed from me were toxic relationships, and believe me, I had plenty of resentments. I had plenty of them. And anything else that could be harmful to me. But above all, what was left me were the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous and the men and women in AA that were teaching this 32-year-old woman to grow up. And I've noticed in those the years that I've been here, I worked with young kids. Some were developmentally disabled. They were adults. Some of them were kids, hard of hearing. And I noticed that the growth of a one-year-old is very similar to us in AA. Mm-hmm. We're totally dependent upon our parents, our sponsor, or people, you know, change our diapers, wipe our nose, you know, make sure we get fed and safe. And 2 years old, we're toddlers. We say, no, 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 mine, mine, mine. I can do it myself. And, of course, we have the terrible threes in AA, and you see a toddler do the same thing. My mental and emotional stability growth was stunted somewhere way, way, way back there. But what happened is that I started growing up emotionally, mentally, as well as growing older in AA, but I was growing up. And this Pat did always tell me, she said, Cheryl, you know, the first 7 years you're in sobriety is like planting a tree. Now, if you plant it straight up, that's the way it's going to grow. If you're going to plant it slanted, that's the way it's going to grow. So get your roots based in the program, the steps, the traditions, and now the concepts for those of us who are that far into it. But all of those things were the basis of it. And when she was talking about doing the inventory steps, my gosh, four and five, I thought I was a piece of poop. And she got real testy about that. She says, honey, God don't make no junk. And I said, what? She says, say that. I said, God don't make no junk. She says, no, say it. God don't make no junk. I want you to say it. God don't make no junk. Oh, come on, give it to me. But I did junky things. And that was the inventory. And if you ever bought a home and you had to fill out a financial statement, you have your liabilities and you have your assets. And I could not see any assets whatsoever. And she made me list them in this inventory. She says, do you hurt little animals? And I go, no. She says, write that down. And it was little things like that that helped me get through the fourth and fifth step. And of course, I had to tell my deepest, darkest secrets. And she said, oh my God, I did that too. And that just put her off that pedestal that I had so graciously put her on. She didn't want that spot, but that's where I had her. And the cool thing was that my sponsor was sponsored by a lady by the name of Betty Thomas. And Betty Thomas talked to a man, Chuck Chamberlain, all the time. So we were in their homes constantly. I got to see the bedrock of what AA in Orange County was going to be like. And those people were the ones that I was growing up with in Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I was ready to do that fifth step, I was dropping it like rabbit pellets all over Orange County, a little here, a little there, a little here, a little there. I was afraid if you guys got it all together, there was going to be scary times coming for me. But that's not true. Anyway, it did happen that I was able to get through the fifth step and get that honest connection with the sponsor. By the time six and seven... six, you know, you humbly, you're going to ask him to remove the shortcomings? I don't think so. Some of these guys still work for me. And I use them quite eloquently. One of them was sarcasm. I loved to think that Don Rickles was my hero. And if I could just cut you down just a little bit, I could feel bigger and better about myself. And one day, 18 months sober, I said something to a woman, and for the first time I noticed the pain and the hurt on her face. And that was that aha moment. I finally recognized that particular character defect. Now, I knew I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. I didn't steal anything big like they talk about in step eight, but I did find myself going, oh my God, that I've stole time from my family, raising my kids. I resented it. My girls wanted to be in the Olympics, but I resented getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and taking them swimming. I resented the fact that they had school afterwards where they had to be someplace because it was cutting into my drinking. That's the kind of thief I was. I lied about it when I was drinking. You want what? I have something important over here. If it wasn't for that moment in time when I had been to that fashion show and I'd taken my girls to the babysitter, but somehow I don't remember coming back from that fashion show. I don't remember picking the kids up. I don't remember bringing them in the house except the baby was 9 months old. And I laid her at the bottom of the bed, but when I woke up, she wasn't there. In my drunkenness, I had kicked her off the bed. That was when I tripped over into obsessive drinking. And I carried that guilt all the way into sobriety. Being able to sit down and talk to someone about that type of pain, that kind of shame, was absolutely mind-boggling freedom. I love step seven because it has that word in there that the first time I heard it, I gagged like a maggot, humility. Humiliation is in there two times. Humble is in there three times. And 28 times the word humility. Must be an awfully important word. And here I was sitting there thinking, I don't get this. Why do we have to do it? Well, it was humiliating when I was barfing up in your bathroom and using your monogram towels to clean it up with. And they walk in and say, can I help you? And you're going, oh, I'm doing this fine. You know, that was humiliation. The humbling moment was standing in front of that bathroom mirror and looking into it and saying, God, I don't want to die like her. Humility, 28 times. Alternate word for it is teachable. Because my mind had always been closed. I had a closed mind. But when I opened my mind through being humble, I was able to learn. And you were my teachers. You still are. And I learned that was my journey, is to learn how to be an adult, how to be who I am today. I was promised then, and I now feel it's been fulfilled. I got to become the woman that God always intended for me to be. And I like this person. And I find that I do make everybody happy. But, you know, that is one thing I always worried about. Do you like me? Do you like me? Do you like me? Well, here's the thing. I know that I make everybody happy. 90% are happy to see me come. 10% are happy to see me go. Everybody's happy. You know? You got to figure on that, because I don't know whether you get it or not, but my sobriety is I try not to take myself too damn serious, because I've told you all about my foibles and everything, but, you know, life was in session from the day I was born, but I've learned some with it, with a lot of dignity and grace, that you just don't really get a great chance to listen to. But here's the thing. You get to clean up your act. So 9 and 10 are my favorites, you know. I didn't want to go out and apologize. I'm sorry you were a jerk to me. I forgive you. It's not an amends. Now, if you've ever noticed that the Constitution has 27 amendments, an amendment means to change. And my behavior hadn't changed, but I began to understand that there were certain people out there that I had hurt. My husband, my children. I don't have a lot of family, but it was the people in AA. Learning how to own my own behavior and try to change it. Like I said, that sarcasm, I didn't stop being sarcastic that day, but from that moment forward, I was willing to change. I was willing to let it go, and it's gone. But it comes back in a different outfit. You know, that's one thing about character defects. They are fashionistas. They change outfits, and I don't recognize them. And that's one of them. Oh, I didn't know I did that. Huh, what about that? But all that in 9, going out and making amends. I dumped 2 milkshakes down the U.S. Post Office mail chutes during Christmas because I had a resentment towards the mailman because he wouldn't take my packages because I improperly packed them. I'll show you. I went to McDonald's and got 2 milkshakes. I'll show you. So I tell my sponsor this one, and she goes, honey, I don't think we're going to go right to the source on that one. So she made me commit to doing community service for an event that I had to do it for free and for fun, and she says, at least 200 hours. Well, it turned out a little nonprofit organization called John Tracy Clinic for Deaf Children. Now, I had been deaf as a kid with the mumps, so I knew what deafness was like, and for some reason, I not only fell in love with that, but I stayed with that commitment and that amend for 10 years. It turned out that it was also going to be the basis for what my later life was going to be, because I had an opportunity later on to work with deaf children and adults, as well as developmentally disabled. It makes me a better sponsor, I'll tell you that right now, because you got to look at some of the basic things. We come in, we are not well. And when you look and you go, oh, my God, oh, that's nice, honey. That's nice. I understand. It's one of the, it softens the insides. But step 10, I like that one. It's almost like owning a car. There's certain things I have to do on a daily basis in step 10. There's certain things I have to do in on a semi-annual basis, and there's something I have to do on an annual basis. Daily, I have to pray and meditate. Daily, when I'm wrong, probably meditate, or I blame somebody else. That's my version of it. But the point of it is that I do it on a daily basis. That Creator's Prayer helps me very much with that. When I go into my semi-annual, that's when I do with my sponsor. I don't do my annual with her. I always pick someone other than, and it's usually at an event, I see a woman and I'll look across the room and say, God, who is she? And she shows up, because there might be something about my sponsor I want to talk about, and I want to be honest. So that's why I do that. And it is suggested that we do that. You know, none of our steps says we have to do them. There's a weasel clause in every step that we do, every single one of them. The first one says, well, if you don't believe you're an alcoholic, go out and have some more drinking. Step 11, which I'm about to talk about, is we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. Well, now I've got this relationship with God, and she would say, meditation is like the message going out. The prayer is the, no, it's just the opposite. The prayer is the meditation, is the message going out. Meditation is the message coming in. And I do believe there is a God because I hear that voice. Now, that voice strangely sounds like my own. It never shouts at me. It never says a lot. But I tell you, I do believe. Because there are times, and it talks about it even in step 11, sometimes we're seized with a rebellion so sickening we can't pray. We won't pray. Don't think too ill of yourself. Resume prayer because you know it's good for you. A good weasel clause, because I've never done anything perfect. When I was 5 years sober, 8 years sober, I was unfriended by someone that I adored, and she decided that my decisions weren't applicable to her life. So turns out she is going to become the chair of a woman's retreat that I'm going to go to. And I tell my friends, I'm not going now that she happens to be the chair. I'm not going because of her. Da, 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 da. I get up, I wake up in the morning, and I hear a voice that says, you have to grow on separate paths. That's all I heard. And I knew it wasn't my voice. But I get up there to the retreat, and the first thing that woman sees me, she comes over, she says, Cheryl, I'm so glad you're here. Can we talk? So we go to later in the afternoon, in the evening, sit by the fireplace, and she says, I owe you an apology. We had to grow on separate paths, identical words. Is that odd or is that God? That's where I learned about step 11. Now, if you talk about step 12, it encompasses all of my steps. The first three tells me what I am, how I can do it, and who I can do it with. And then, of course, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and 9, we're cleaning up our act, we're going out, and then the last one, step 12, being of service. All being of service. Now, even when I was first in those meetings in the beginning, maybe it was cleaning up ashtrays, maybe it was cleaning up toilets, maybe it was standing at the door greeting. Then I got to be a treasurer, then I got to be a secretary, and I even did the intergroup for a while. Got to be an assistant manager down at our central office for 6 weeks because our regular manager was out for illness. I got to be everything there is about Cheryl in these rooms. You were my friend, you were my lover, you were my father, you're my mother, you taught me all of these things because of all those steps. And to have a good guide, and you know, I don't know whether I told you or not, but my sponsor would absolutely, she'd say, Cheryl, I suggest. Well, I heard later on when a sponsor suggests, it's really a silent demand. And I would sit there and I'd listen to her. And I look across this room and I see that our time is almost up. And I do feel the pleasure and the joy of spending all this time with you guys. I got to see something of a beginning. This South Bay, this whole building with men young in recovery. I do have a question, though. Are there any women here with 1 year or under? If so, would you raise your hand? Okay, keep it up, honey. Just keep it up, keep it up, keep it up. Boys, is there any men in here with a year or under? Raise your hand. Keep it up. Ladies, red flag. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you for coming, and I hope you come back again. Let's give Cheryl another hand. All right, I'd like to thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for a fantastic dinner. We will now close in the usual manner with a prayer of our speaker's choice.
We're going to close out with the wee version of the Serenity Prayer.
just circle up.
Giggle.